This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Last night, Amtrak train 188 derailed near the Port Richmond section of Philadelphia. Six people were killed, many more injured, some critically. Investigators will be looking into the cause of the accident that reportedly took place at a curve in the track. Amtrak service between D.C. and New York is suspended today. We asked Alan Zaremski to join us. He's the director of the Railroad Engineering and Safety Program at the University of Delaware. And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Let me just give out the phone number to our listeners. Any questions or comments, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Alan, how do investigators begin to investigate an accident such as this?
Okay. The first stage of the accident investigation is the information gathering and data collection stages. There are a series of different pieces of information, data, that the investigators have to collect, starting with the event recorder on the locomotive, which is similar to a airplane black box. The records all of the key engineer or driver operations, including how he handles the throttle, the brakes, and all the other related operations of the train. Then there's the on-the-ground investigation to see, to collect any potential broken pieces, fractures, if there's a failure that seems to be associated with a failed component, that the pieces are collected for potential metallurgical examination in that case. There are various systems that are built into the railroad track structure and in the operating system that records ancillary information, such as wheel impact detectors that measure the condition of the wheel and record those information. And again, that information will be collected to see if there were any information that be useful in the investigation. There are, of course, the discussions with eyewitnesses, passengers on the train, crew members, etc. So this is all part of the information gathering stage of the process.
Just looking at the numbers of people who were injured, the fact that six people died, is that significant information in trying to figure out the cause of this derailment?
The number of people who died may not be directly relevant to the mechanism, but it's relevant to the circumstances of how they died in terms of what was the energy, was the cars turned over, what was the position of the cars, what were the there's a whole range of information that can be gathered that's related to the amount of energy involved in the derailment, that if at some point we have to do simulation modeling, for example, to try to simulate the conditions leading up to the derailment, then that that information becomes extremely valuable.
I'm assuming the options are things like the condition of the tracks, maybe something even on the tracks, the speed of the train. Are all those possible causes?
Those are all possible contributing factors. Well, you know, for example, the railroad will pull all the records on all the inspection of the track, both the visual inspection, the most recent inspections by the track geometry vehicles, the most recent inspections by the rail test vehicles. For example, Amtrak in the Northeast Corridor does extremely frequent inspections of the track using a very sophisticated track geometry vehicle, which records the all of the key parameters of the geometry of the track. That will be looked at very, very carefully. speed is one of the information that will actually come out of the event recorder. So they will get a very accurate indication of speed for the entire time period, not just at the time of derailment, but all the events and all the speed changes leading up to the derailment will come out of the event recorder. So again, these are all inputs into the investigation to help determine what the cause is, because the cause can be one of several, one of many different parameters, and it's very early at the stage of the game to make that determination.
This is a very busy corridor. I mean, anyone that has taken the Amtrak train knows that. These are also tracks or next to tracks used by freight trains, used by commuter trains. This is a very well used section of track and raises a whole host of questions, I guess, about the multiple uses of the track.
Amtrak has an extremely good safety record on the Northeast Corridor. And the standards that the track is maintained to are pretty tight. The higher the speed of the train, the tighter the standards to which the track is maintained. That's part and parcel of the federal standards, and it's also part and parcel of the railroad's own standards. The fact that it's a very busy track means that it does have to be inspected very carefully and very mm-hmm. regularly, and that will certainly be part of the process that they're going through right now to make sure that the inspections were properly carried out and at the frequency required, and that there was no excessive deterioration or degradation of the track structure as part of the investigation.
And my understanding, I know you have to leave us in a couple of minutes. My understanding is that there is a curve in this section of the track. I'm assuming that trains have to slow down going through cities, and obviously have to slow down if there are curves in the track.
I haven't seen the speed profile for this piece of track, but usually you do slow down for curves. Particularly high-speed trains would tend to have to acquire to slow down on the curves. How much they slow down for, what the actual allowable speed on the curb is a function of the actual degree of curvature, how sharp the curve is, the amount of elevation of the curve, which is you think of it as banking in a highway. Railway curves are also elevated, so the outside rails are a little higher than the inside rail, and that allows you to go through the curves faster because of the dynamics of the forces generated during the curving process. Again, I have not seen the specifics of this particular curve, so I'm not familiar. I can't speak about it right now because I just haven't seen the numbers yet. But I will, as a general rule, you do slow down on curves, correct?
Well, Alan Zaremski, I know you've been very busy this morning. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Director of the Railroad Engineering and Safety Program at the University of Delaware. Joining us now is WHYY reporter Tom McDonald, and he is at the scene. He was there last night shortly after the crash, and he's at the scene in the Port Richmond section of Philadelphia. And Tom, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Is just taking the podium to give us an update on what's going on here. We are trying to find out this is the first update since about early this morning. We have been told that the National Transportation Safety Board is on the ground, and they are doing their work to go over what is happening with this crash. We do know at this point that the mayor is working with the crews and everybody here, and everybody is on site now. And they are working very hard to find out the cause of this accident.
And what you were referring to, Tom, is the fact that Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter is also at the scene and either about to begin a press conference there talking about, I guess, what he knows about what happened. Can you describe the scene for our listeners, what you see there? You were there last night. What does it look like this morning?
Well, it reminds me of a children's train crash when you have your holiday trains and they run them a little too fast. There's a zigzag pattern to the trains, and one of the trains is actually pointing perpendicular to the main trains that have all gone off the track. there is a piece of metal that has gone through one of the trains, bisecting it. And, of course, all the people had to get off the train. Fire department, police department, personnel, first responders cleared things out as quickly as possible.
Are there investigators then on site? Can you see people working? And would it be fair to say that has everyone been accounted for as far as you know, Tom?
We do not have a definitive update on that. The mayor early this morning said that they were not sure that everyone was accounted for. And the NTSB is on site and they are working to make sure that this is determined, the cause, as soon as possible.
A number of people, in fact, perhaps you can tell us how many people were sent to area hospitals, I guess largely to Temple University Hospital. And last night, five people were killed. And as of this morning, it's now six people who've been killed. And Tom, I also read that a number of people are still in critical condition. Can you give us an update on that?
Well, the wounded that were taken to, injured, I should say, were taken to various area hospitals. We don't have a total on how many, although the numbers range anywhere from 50 to over 100.
And what is this neighborhood like? This is the Port Richmond section of Philadelphia for our listeners. Who lives around
here?
Well,
I do want to clarify. This is actually the Frankfort section of Philadelphia. Okay. Port Richmond is on the other side of Aramingo Avenue.
Okay, Frankfort.
What we have here is a working-class neighborhood. There used to be a Catholic high school that is now another school. And this is a family neighborhood, a neighborhood with people. But the area where the crash occurred is beyond the residential section. It's in an industrial section where there used to be a pipe manufacturing plant and a slaughterhouse. There's now a strip mall and a few other things in the area, including a convenience store.
And what was it like to be there last night?
Well, kind of surreal because they didn't have enough light. Everything was pitch black, and they were all searching with flashlights to get people out as quickly as possible. So they were getting the light in as quickly, but they were also working hard to get people out of that area.
And, Tom, about a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, has Mayor Nutter, has he started his press conference?
Yeah, he started a few minutes ago. He still has said the number of those who have perished in this is six, and they are still working to reconcile all the people who are on the trains.
And is there any timetable from what you know about when the trains will be scheduled to run again? They have been suspended, the trains between Washington, D.C. and New York. Any word on that, Tom?
Well, I can tell you last night they cut the overhead wires that provide power to these trains. Plus, they're going to have to do a lot of investigation before they free up the area. And the NTSB is very thorough. So I definitely would not say today. And the mayor said that it could be through the rest of this week.
Well, on that note, Tom, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
You're welcome, Marty.
And that's a Tom McDonald, WHYY reporter. As he said, the site of the derailment in the Frankfort section of Philadelphia, I had said Port Richmond, these are two neighborhoods rather close to each other, but the Frankfort section of the city, and again, six people killed in that derailment, a number of people who have been injured, and some of them critically. And do stay with WHYY throughout the day. There will be updates on this very worrisome derailment that happened in Philadelphia. We're going to be shifting gears as we go ahead in this hour of Radio Times, talking about the pension crisis, both in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Aim. Ask New Jersey Governor Chris Christie about the public pension crisis in New Jersey, and he'll tell you he's done more to address the problem than previous governors. Ask unions and Democrats, and you'll get a different answer. The New Jersey Supreme Court is currently weighing in on a dispute between the governor and public worker unions over a pension deal. Our guest is Ari Podgal, has been covering the story for ProPublica, where he writes about finance. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me. My thoughts are with the victims of the people who died in the horrible train derailment in Philadelphia.
Indeed. In fact, we just spent some time talking about that, and we'll be updating people as we go along. But we did also want to talk about this public pension crisis because, frankly, it is a crisis. And I wonder if you could kind of get us up to speed in New Jersey. What kind of liability does New Jersey face?
Well, it depends how you count it. There's some new accounting standards that are being phased in right now, and under those standards, if you include all the states' unfunded liabilities, you know, you get anywhere from, you know, it was previously $37 billion of unfunded liabilities for the state's pension systems, or under the new standards, it looks like it could be more like $82 billion. So any way you count it, it really is a huge amount of money for the state of New Jersey and for the taxpayers.
And we know that many, probably most states, have some degree of liability. Do you know, is New Jersey in bigger trouble than other states?
Well, the rankings change all the time, but, you know, the threshold that's used commonly is that 80% is considered a well-funded plan. And I think as of the 2013 fiscal year, the state was somewhere around 55, so it's well below that.
Now, back in 2011, this goes back a couple of years, the Christie administration negotiated this pension reform deal with unions, also with Democrats. What is it that they came up with?
Yeah, it was a very important reform, and it was actually hailed as a model fix. The biggest part of it was eliminating cost of living adjustments for pensioners. There was also a reduction in future benefits for retirees and increased contributions from current workers, all of which, if you take it together, meant that the state's liability would decrease by about $120 billion over 30 years. That was the estimate at the time, two-thirds of which was the biggest piece was this cost of living adjustment, which, you know, would mean that much less money would have to be increased each year for the pension payments to retirees. And then previously there was also another part of it, which was that the state would increase its contributions to pension funds by stepping them up by 1/7 each year, so that in 7 years' time the state would be making the full amount of contributions to the state pension systems that actuaries recommend they should be making. So those two parts together were supposed to fix the system.
So what happened?
Well, it didn't quite play out that way.
No, it didn't.
One of the things that's sort of plagued Governor Christie during the past few years of his administration is that the state economy hasn't been recovering as fast as, you know, those in other states. That meant that income tax receipts haven't come in as projected, and that, of course, meant that those payments that were supposed to be made to the pension systems, you know, in that sort of seventh schedule, just he hasn't had the money to do that. So, for example, last year when they had the latest shortfall in 2014, the governor made the decision to cut the scheduled payments for 2014 and 2015 by about $2.5 billion. The courts upheld the 2014 cut, which was sort of made at the last minute when the state really didn't have much of a choice. But the 2015 cut they disagreed with. And in February, just before the governor's budget message, a judge in New Jersey ordered the governor to find $1.57 billion in additional money to put into the pension systems by June 30th of this year.
And my understanding is also that the unions, I guess, have taken this to the court. And I'm looking at a quote from the New Jersey Supreme Court. One of the justices there wondered if the state, which would be Christie, had engaged in something he called bait and switch.
Well, it's difficult to get into the governor's head in terms of what he was thinking at the time. But, you know, he has certainly been right that this is a big problem for the state, and he has tried to tackle it. The problem is that by not putting in the money that he agreed to put into the pensions, you know, he's making the problem worse because, you know, the more you skip out on those payments that are needed to make up for the past underfunding, the harder it is to fix the problem. So it's one of those things that really the state has to figure out some way to do it within the next few years, or otherwise the problem becomes unsolvable.
Well, and also this was part of a deal that was negotiated with the unions. I can imagine
right.
that they're not so happy about the fact that he didn't, stick up to his end of the bargain.
Right. And, of course, if you listen to the Senate President, Stephen Sweeney, he says that all the time, you know, that Governor Christie hasn't held up his part of the bargain by not putting in the money. And that's one of the big difficulties right now, because it does make, by not putting in the amounts that he has agreed to, it does make future cooperation more difficult. And future cooperation is really exactly what you're going to need from both parties in the state of New Jersey to find a solution to this, because it is, none of the decisions are easy here. I mean, you either have to raise taxes or you have to find some way to reduce benefits and reform the system. You can only hope that they don't borrow again to fund the pension system, since that hasn't worked out when they've done it in the past.
Well, I want to pick up on that. But what the judge at least said to the state, or I guess to the governor, his administration, had to come up with $1.5 billion by June 30th.
Right.
Is that even possible?
depends who you ask in Trenton. I mean, you know, one of the proposals that are floated by the Democrats is this millionaire's tax, which, you know, by imposing a tax on higher income people, you could raise money. And the governor, I've heard him address that at the town halls. You know, when he references it, he says that, you know, that's one way you could do it. He doesn't want to raise taxes on already overburdened taxpayers in the state of New Jersey. So he doesn't see that as a solution. He doesn't think it would even come close to getting the state $1.57, $1.6 billion by year's end. So then the other solutions are, well, you know, can you try to find some ways to move money around, which, you know, the state has been doing in previous years. And I'm not even sure if they could do that again to a significant enough degree to really come up with an extra $1.6 billion by June 30th. It's a lot of money
for the
state.
And the fact that the state has had its bond ratings lowered a couple of times, is that because of this pension problem?
That's exactly the main driver. You know, when we were doing our story on the state's finances in New Jersey under Governor Christie, you know, just the day before we published, the ninth downgrade came down, you know, and we had to change in the copy from eight downgrades to nine. And the major reason there was really just the continued sort of stalemate over how to find a solution to this, you know, to this pension problem in the state. You know, there's also other reasons in past downgrades. For example, in past downgrades, the governor, you know, has been cited for, you know, budget fixes, you know, like one-time infusions of cash, like a tobacco bond refinancing that he did in 2014. But really the major driver of this and in other downgrades, for example, in the city of Chicago yesterday, is just it's pensions, pensions, pensions.
Indeed. Well, let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Cesare Podkol. He's been covering the public pension crisis in New Jersey. He's been covering this story for ProPublica, where he writes about finance. ProPublica and the Washington Post teamed up to investigate some of the finances in New Jersey. And just a quick reminder, we did begin our hour talking about the derailment in Philadelphia, the Amtrak derailment that led to the death of six passengers on a train last night. Looks like dozens, maybe even more than 100 people injured. And again, to listeners of WHYY, we will keep you up to speed on news as it happens throughout the day. But we are talking about public pensions. It's a wonky topic. It's also a very important topic. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Cesare, you have written about the fact that Chris Christie has claimed that he has put more money into the pension system than previous governors. Now, this gets us a bit into the weeds, but how does he make that claim and does it hold up?
Well, it's an important point because this is what the governor mentioned to the state legislature in his budget address in February. And when we looked into it, we realized that that claim wasn't entirely accurate. The way he got to that figure of about, you know, $4.2 billion in cumulative contributions that we'll have made by the end of the next fiscal year is by you know, first of all, you know, including money hasn't yet put in on his end. But then when he looks at past governors, including Governor Whitman in the 1990s, he excluded about $2.75 billion that she put into the state pension systems in 1997. Now, he did that because that contribution came from the sale of debt. So that's money that the state of New Jersey has to repay with interest to make that pension contribution. So in his view, when we asked the state treasurer about that, you know, they said that it's just not apples to apples to count debt as a pension contribution. However, the fact remains that the money did go in to the pensions at that time, so it did increase, you know, the amount of assets that the pensions had to meet benefits in the future. So it wasn't fair to exclude that, and we point that out in the piece. And in fact, when you do include it, then, you know, Governor Whitman made about $3.7 billion in pension contributions during her tenure, compared to about $2.2 billion so far for the governor. So it's certainly, you know, he has been making more contributions. For example, he's now currently more than Governor Corzine, but it's certainly not more than any previous administration by nearly double, as he claimed during his budget address.
And as you said, Governor Whitman used a bond sale. This goes back to 1997 to make the payment contribution. But, you know, with the advantage of hindsight, was that a smart way to raise money to pay off some of the pension debt?
In hindsight, no. And I can explain quickly why. The way this debt sale was structured was it included about $1.14 billion of what's called zero-coupon bonds or capital appreciation bonds. And what that means is you don't pay interest on a going basis as it comes due. Instead, you kind of let it add up until, you know, it comes due all at once in a big balloon payment at the end. It's sort of like if instead of paying the interest on your mortgage each month, you would just let it add up until 30 years down the line, you owe a huge amount of money. And it's considered poor fiscal management to sell debt that way because you're basically shifting the obligations on future generations, right? And that's basically what they did with this bond sale. And those zero-coupon bonds that were part of that pension financing, they're now coming due, and they're coming due at the worst possible time for the state of New Jersey. They're coming due in serious amounts. Just to give you one quick example, this past February, we were working on the story, about $219 million on one of those pieces of those zero coupons came due. You know, the state only got $59 million for that in 1997, yet it had to pay $219 million, to repay it, just this past February, some 18 years later. And that's still a good scenario because within a few years, the other remaining parts of it, they're going to be paying back $384 million a year coming due on these things, and including the other parts of the debt that were part of this, $2.75 billion, debt contribution to the pensions. You're going to be looking at $500 million. That's going to be hitting the state budget year after year from 2022 to 2029. It's a lot of money. It's going to be over $10 billion that the state will have repaid on this debt to make that contribution. And to make things worse, they didn't get the returns they were expecting. So they're paying more in the interest on those bonds than they're actually making for the pension system. And they can't refund those zero coupons, meaning they can't just issue new debt at a lower interest rate. Interest rate is locked in, and it's locked in for decades.
And I do want to get to some callers, but I think it does speak to the fact that not just in New Jersey, but it looks like in states across the country, the idea was to sort of kick the can down the road.
That's a very important point. And, that's the issue here. It's one of the smartest things I heard when I was reporting on New Jersey was someone mentioned to me that, 20 years ago, the idea was, we can make these changes and no one will notice. And now it is 20 years later, and people are noticing. Bondholders are noticing. Investors are noticing. Taxpayers are noticing. Rating agencies especially are noticing. They're downgrading left and right.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Frank from Robbinsville, New Jersey, joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Frank. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. The conversation is actually very poignant. I am a state employee. What people seem to forget is the discussion of all the monetary requirements that need to be paid out to the pensioners and future pensioners like myself, future pensioner, is that we've got a contract. I've got 20-some-odd years. There's people who's got who have 10 years. Whatever amount of time you've got, there's a period with which you're vested in the system. It's usually a 10-year period. In the state of New Jersey, that's what it is. And we've come into the state employment with a contract and an understanding of this is what we're going to come out with. And to change that, it's criminal to think that you're going to change a plan that people have bought into. I mean, I would have gone to private sector employment. I could have made not double the money, amount of money, but pretty significant amounts of money beyond what I make at a state employment because this is what I bought into. I bought into a plan. And for the discussion to get boiled down to, this is sort of the deficit that we're in. This is what the liability is for the state. It wasn't that the pensioners are not the problem. It's the politicians who created this problem that then pawn it off and make the public think that it's the public employees' issue. We didn't create this issue. You can blame the unions a little bit. There's a little bit of blame to go around. But quite honestly, 20 years ago when I sat in a union meeting and I heard Governor Christy Todd Whitman propose these crazy ideas and the unions telling us this, I stood up and said, this is lunacy. How can we, or even the public, get hoodwinked into a plan where, and I even remember saying 20 years down the line, we're going to be standing here, and it's a concerted effort to break down unions, to break down pensioners' plans, and we're here. 20 years later, it's exactly as a lot of us have predicted.
Well, Frank, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and it's Cesari, in many ways, these deals negotiated, these contracts signed, these are promises made to either government employees, to teachers, firefighters, police officers.
Right. No, Frank, you're right. It is a promise that's made. And there's sort of two parts to it. One is, it is a contract that you sign. And that's actually one of the reasons why the Illinois State Supreme Court just this past Friday, a few days ago, overturned the state of Illinois' landmark pension reform that they signed into law in 2013. that would have, reduced cost of living adjustments there, because they found that, you know, it's part of the Constitution, it's protected in the Constitution, and you can't, you know, reduce a contract like that. So that's part of the reason it's being challenged. But the other side of the equation, you know, to be fair to the governor of New Jersey in terms of the statements he makes, is, you know, that there just isn't the money to keep those promises now. And it goes back to politicians, you know, over-promising, and now there just isn't the money to deliver on those promises. So changes have to be made. Otherwise, you know, I mean, you're already seeing the downgrades, and, you know, that's, you know, absent any change, I mean, that's just not going to stop.
Well,
it's
a real
problem that has to be dealt with.
What are the options? You mentioned that the taxes on millionaires. I mean, no governor likes to raise taxes, and I know from all the shows we do about New Jersey, people pay high property taxes in that state. What are the options for the governor, or for anybody?
They're tough. And the other thing people need to keep in mind is millionaires can move. And a lot of people from New Jersey, you know, moved to Florida. One of the things we were working on when we were looking at New Jersey's finances, we were trying to find some, you know, millionaires to move down to Florida. It wasn't hard to find them, but it was more difficult to get them to talk to you.
I bet.
People do move, you know. People move to Pennsylvania. People move to other states because the property tax burden is already tremendous. You know, we found a person for the story who, you know, a man in the town of Kearney who's featured in one of our stories, who gets $21,000 between him and his wife in Social Security, and $8,000 of that has to go out the door for property taxes. It makes it very difficult to live. And how you raise taxes on an already burdened population to make those ends meet. Those are the difficult policy decisions facing politicians, not just in New Jersey, but across the country.
And we're almost out of time here, but is raising taxes, based on your reporting, is that really the only option in New Jersey?
No, there's certainly other options, but you can also make the governor has championed a proposal that was put forth by his Pension Benefits Study Commission to freeze plans and replace them with less generous plans and negotiate savings to health care plans. There's other options, but the question is always, are they politically viable and what can be done and what can get through the legislature? But one thing is certain, there's certainly no easy options at this point.
And I guess 401ks for future employees, I know, in fact, we're going to be talking a bit about that in just a couple of minutes, but is that an option on the table? In New Jersey?
Well, so the governor has agreed to, as part of this proposal that was put forth by his Benefit Health Study Commission, was that they replace the new plans with the new plan that would be instituted as a cash balance plan, which is sort of a hybrid between a defined benefit and a 401k plan, which would be less generous. And that certainly is one option.
Cesare Podko, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Talking about public pensions in New Jersey, and he's been covering the story for ProPublica. We have another guest waiting in the wings. The mayor of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, will be joining us. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane. The Pennsylvania legislature is grappling with public pensions this week, a big ticket item for the budget. The Senate is voting on a plan to put new employees in a 401k or defined contribution type of retirement plan and make some changes in the benefit formula. Governor Wolf favors borrowing to pay down the pension debt, which is in the billions. We asked Rick Gray to join us. He's the mayor of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, also part of a coalition of mayors in Pennsylvania alarmed about the state's pension problems. And Mayor Gray, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, it's good to be here, Marty. Yeah, one thing I should say, we're interested primarily in the municipal pension problem, which is great, but not as great as the state municipal or the state pension problem. We're dealing primarily with reform of the state local system.
Well, and just to make sure our listeners understand the difference, as far as the state is concerned, there's something like $53 billion of unfunded obligations for the two state retirement systems. Municipal pensions unfunded by something like $7.7 billion, still a lot of money.
There are 562 distressed municipal pension plans, both union and non-union. Pennsylvania has more municipal pension plans than any other state in the union. In fact, I've heard the figure, it's over 25% of all the municipal pension plans in the United States are in Pennsylvania. And for example, Lancaster has a firefighter's pension plan, a police pension plan, and a non-uniform pension plan. We have advisors, investment advisors, actuaries, accountants for each of the three plants. A city our size has that. So you multiply that across the state, and they're everywhere. And it's not just cities. It's townships and boroughs, and cities all have the problem.
Well, what is the situation in Lancaster? I was looking at some numbers, and it looks like Lancaster might be a little better off than some of the other cities, municipalities in the Commonwealth.
We are, and one of the reasons we are is we raise taxes. I've been in office now. This is my ninth year. When I first got in, our pension would cost us about $2 million a year. Now it costs us $6 million a year. In really 8 years, that has happened in Lancaster. The result is that we have more people, for example, firefighters. We have more insured firefighters that are retired than are working. We have pension costs that just continue to rise year after year. And again, the city's 60,000 people. There's only so much you can bear. Our property taxes are really the only source of income that we can adjust to pay these. So, you know, we're struggling, though we're 70-some percent funded. Some of the cities, Scranton, I understand their firefighters plan is 16% funded.
16.
Well, what does that mean? Well, it means in a couple of years they're not going to have the money to pay the retired firefighters.
So what are the options facing municipalities in the Commonwealth?
Well, first of all, the initial option is to man up in Harrisburg, and really, I don't mean that in a sexist term, but to confront the problem and deal with the problem. You had initially spoken about state pensions. They have begun to deal with state pensions, and we're afraid that they won't deal with the municipal pension problem. If they don't deal with it this year, next year is an election year. Chances are small that they're going to want to confront the difficult decisions that have to be made when dealing with these plans during an election year. So we're probably talking about 2017 before we get any relief. Meanwhile, the Auditor General said last year, or last 2 years, this unfunded municipal pensions have grown by $1 billion. In 2 years. So if we wait another 2 years, we can assume that figure will be matched or exceeded. There has to be a sense of urgency in Harrisburg, and we're trying to convey that to them. But it's difficult. They've got problems right there.
Indeed. What can or what would you like then the state to do to help out the municipalities?
Well, there's numerous things going on. One, Act 111 needs some reforms, and that is the binding arbitration that's done with police and fire and public safety unions. Most of us are Democrats, as I am. I'm 100% in support of the right to organize, and also I'm in support of binding arbitration. On the other hand, the way the binding arbitration has evolved, it's arbitrary arbitration. There's no appeal, there's no standards, there's no consideration given to the ability of the municipality to pay. Plus, they've included in their pension issues. Some cities, though Lancaster doesn't have this problem, have spiking problems, which means the pension for the police officer will be based on his or her last year of service, a percentage of that. Well, they work as much overtime as they can. They really do 1.25, 1.5 what their normal salary would be. That's what their pension is then based on. There's some pension plans that have cost of livings in them. Well, that over, if you retire at 50, which people do from these plans, 25 years, they're out. It means another 30, 40 years the municipality is paying that with a cost-of-living approach or cost-of-living built into it. It's almost impossible to budget that amount of money. You just don't have it, and you can't get it. So the first thing, again, is for Harrisburg to recognize that this is a serious problem that must be addressed immediately. And if it isn't addressed, it's not going to go away. It's just going to get worse.
Well, picking up on what you first said about what people's pensions are based on, if it's their last year of work and then they, you know, add lots of overtime to increase their salary, are you suggesting look at the last 5 years or the last 10 years of someone's employment and then base it on something like that?
Everybody has a base rate, and there's a bill, House Bill 316, that provides that the base rate for that person's position is used to determine their contribution and also the municipality's contribution. There's a provision in there that we will have to pay a certain amount above the 30-year Treasury note. And if we make more money, if we make so much money 1 year that we have excess money, we can use that to fund the current liabilities under the current plan. Your previous speaker spoke about the inability to change benefits once they're granted. Pennsylvania has a similar constitutional provision. We can't change the benefits for the people that are currently getting them or entitled to them. What we'd like to do is freeze those benefits at this point. Freeze them, keep them there, keep them at that level, and then begin the reform for new hires. We're talking about probably a 15 or 20 year period before it would make any real substantive difference. Yet on the other hand, if they would have thought about this 15 or 20 years ago, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in right now. So it requires not only dealing with the problem right now, which is distasteful politically and difficult politically, but it also requires people to look far ahead and say, these are the ramifications of what we're doing. It's what they didn't do during the Ridge administration that created a lot of problems for them the state level.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Rick Gray. He's the
Sorry.
Mayor. No, no, that's okay, because I want to pick up on several things that you just said. Also give out the phone number to our listeners. And just a recap here, we did begin our conversation talking about the train derailment here in Philadelphia, and I'm inviting our listeners to stay with WHYY for updates throughout the day. But we did want to also talk about the public pension crisis, both in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania. It is real as well. And again, Rick Gray is our guest. He's the mayor of Lancaster, part of a coalition of mayors around the Commonwealth concerned about the pension crisis, if I can put it that way, here in Pennsylvania. And to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @whyyradiotimes. Rick Gray, picking up on what you said and even looking a little bit at the history of paying or promising to pay or underpaying or kicking down the road to pay for public pensions, would it be fair to say, looking back over the 20 years, that there were overpromises in the past and then underfunding that went along with that?
Well, if you have your own retirement plan, you look at the age that you intend to retire, be it 20 years or 25 years, and you invest accordingly and build up funds so that you can live somewhat economically secured in your retirement. What happened here was, first of all, the promises were boosted. They boosted the ability and the amounts to provide it for people who were retiring or going to retire. Then when the stock market was doing really well and they looked real good and they looked funded, rather than figure, yeah, we'll overfund it this year because next year the stock market might not do as well, they didn't put money into it. And sooner or later, that chicken comes home to roost, and it's come home to roost. When the market gets flat or when the market drops, then you don't have that money that you were counting on. It was just poor economic planning. Poor economic planning and political expediency for the immediate problem, the immediate need. How are you going to deal with it right now? And not looking down the road as to what's going to occur. Marty, I'll give you an example of what they considered reform. During the recession, we were told you have to be funded at a certain level, but you can count the assets in your plan as 130% of what they actually are. stuff. You have a million in your plan. You can say, or you can say, we have 1,300,000 in our plan.
Oh.
Or Lancaster, we have 100 million. We have 130 million in our plan. Well, we don't. We don't. It, and that way, to give a give an appearance that you actually had more than you do have, really doesn't in any way solve the problem. It's just a quick fix for the immediate time.
How is something like that legal? I mean, you're misrepresenting.
It's called asset smoothing, you know, I had a good time with it when we brought it up with city council, saying, you know, we can pass this budget and spend 30% more than we have under this. It didn't really do anything except postpone things. Sometimes they ask us, do you want more money? You know, we'll give you more money. Is that the problem? And the mayors have consistently said, you know, you're going to have to plug the hole in the boat before you begin bailing. You're going to have to do some systemic reform to these pension plans. If you give us more money, if you give me $1 million more, believe me, we'll end up spending $1.25 million more. We don't want more money. We want systematic or systemic reform of the manner in which these benefits are determined, calculated. And we want to be fair. Our police and fire do not get Social Security. They don't. I didn't know that until I was mayor, that a policeman doesn't get Social Security. So this is the only thing most of them have. You can't promise things that you do not think you're going to be able to deliver in 20 years from now. You have to be fair to them, and you have to be fair to the taxpayers. And fairness means maybe tough love and telling them the truth, that you can't buy bread with promises.
Indeed.
So,
well, you know what? I need to. I just want to get one more caller in, or a caller in, before we have to say goodbye to you, Mayor Gray. We have, looks like, Jerry from Lafayette Hill. Jerry, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, very quickly. I don't understand the entire system. There's no way of correcting what's happened now. But in the future, they have to start changing this to what businesses do, have a 401k, and stop paying people when they retire their medical benefits. And if they just give people a 401k and cut out medical benefits, they're going to cut down in the future the amount of money that they have to pay out to everybody.
Well, Jerry, let me see what Mayor Gray says in response to that. Does that make sense to you?
To me?
Yes, to you.
Well, we can't make those kind of determinations because of Act 111. Act 111 is binding arbitration for public safety personnel, which means an arbiter tells me how much the pension shall be. An arbiter tells me what medical program we have to have. An arbiter will tell me how long we have to have the medical program. Some of it makes sense. Yes, a 401k, I practiced law before I became mayor. That's all I had. That's all I do have right now. That and Social Security. That's my pension plan. So one of those bills is being introduced to have just established 401ks, but I think it would be a very tough move politically to do that, especially for people that don't get Social Security and aren't eligible for Social Security. House Bill 316 provides a cash balance plan, which is sort of like a 401k, but it has some guarantees to the people who participate.
Jerry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Mayor Gray, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Okay, Marty, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Rick Gray, the mayor of Lancaster, again, part of a coalition of mayors in Pennsylvania, concerned, even alarmed about the pension crisis in the Commonwealth. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter, how to listen to us on satellite radio. I almost forgot about that. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.